Future Hacker. Life. Path. Future.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Future Hacker. I'm your host, Maria Taide, with a really bad voice today, so I apologize. And today we have actually two very special guests with us to discuss the future of energy. So first, I'm going to introduce you to a friend of mine, Ankit Garg. He's president of projects with Shapoori Palungji Energy, and please correct me if I said it wrong, I'm sure I did. It's an Indian energy service multinational, and he has the engineering, procurement, construction, and project management of all SP energy projects with the overall responsibility for the execution phase project P&L. He also sits on the board of Shift Clean Energy, a Vancouver, Canada headquartered company that uses proprietary lithium-ion battery-based energy storage technologies to hybridize and electrify ferries, fishing boats, electric aquaculture support vessels, offshore support vessels, tugboats, ports, and more. As the SP Energy thought leader on climate change, energy transition, and sustainability, he devotes a significant range of his managerial bandwidth analyzing the evolving global new energy technology mix and helping set the strategy roadmap for business evolution, especially in the strong agency of offshore floating wind energy. So guys, you can see that he's super, super, super knowledgeable about wind technologies, everything that is wind energy, oil and gas industries, innovations around the energy sector all around the world. He's regularly invited to speak at energy industry conferences in India, China, the Asia Pacific, and the Americas. And, you know, hopefully someday in South America as well, right, Ankit? How are you doing today, my friend?
I'm doing super, Maria. Thank you so much for giving me this opportunity to be with you here today.
Thank you. And, you know, we have also another very special guest because I thought that it would be even more interesting if we had someone with all this knowledge that you have, but also from Brazil, which is, you know, a big player when we talk about renewables as well, right, Renato? And on the user side, user behavior, the, you know, company side. And so it's going to be an interesting meet. So let me introduce you to Renato. He's the managing director of Volt Robotics, which develops smart digital solutions for energy companies. He's in the electrical engineering with executive experience in the energy sector, including COVID account sizing, risk allocation for wind and solar power plants, and strategic planning for energy retailers. He has executive experience as director of regulation, commercialization, and energy planning at EDP Energias in Brazil, which deals with electricity generation, transmission, distribution, and commercialization. So the whole thing. Renato has received training from institutions such as Cornell University, MIT, and IESE Business School. He's also a voluntary professor in postgraduate courses in computational modeling and intelligence systems at the University of São Paulo, USP. Welcome, Renato. Very big introductions here today. It's so great to have you. How are you doing?
Hello, Maria. Hello, Ankit. Well, I'm doing very well. I thank you very, very much for this opportunity. And I hope you have fun and discuss the future of energy together.
We will, you know, too. So, you know, experience is not going to be missing here. And, you know, I really hope that you can get everything that you learned until today. And let's try to picture whatever is going to happen in the future based on everything that is happening all around us, right? So let's begin with Ankit. You know, you work on the oil and gas industry, which you know, we already have so many challenges today with the shift that we are seeing in the world towards these more sustainable energy sources. As much as we all know that we still have to trust the fossil fuel industry for a very, very long time. So regarding the oil and gas, you know, the traditional piece that we're living, what challenges do you see for this industry when talking about moving towards this shift?
Well, Maria, thanks a lot for the question. I feel that the biggest challenge that our industry is facing right now is a challenge of perception. It has to be said that ever since oil was discovered in 1859 in the United States, it has been the bedrock of the global energy system. Oil and gas has played a very important role in making sure that people in the developing countries today, especially over the last two decades, have gotten the opportunity to score ever higher on their respective SDG goals as laid down in the United Nations auspices. And what I have been observing of late is that that reputation or that yeoman service that oil and gas had provided to the world energy system is now getting stigmatized. And I'm not going to sit here and tell you that climate change is not happening. I'm not going to sit here and tell you that it's all, nerd science, etc. I agree. I think we all agree that climate change is happening. I agree that there is something that's got to be done about that. But I think we also need to bear in mind that, there is a big chunk of population out there, particularly in what I call the global south, where energy is still not within the reach of people to the extent that they would want it to be. Let's not forget, for example, that in Africa, where we have about 700 million people today, within the next two decades, or probably by 2050, we are going to be seeing almost a doubling of population there. I strongly feel that oil and gas has a very important role to play going forward in making sure that service is delivered to all these people who will be adding to the global population mix. But having said that, what I'm noticing more and more is that getting financing, for example, for newer oil and gas projects is now becoming difficult, especially with the advent of ESG-focused investing. There's a big set of investors now who want to greenify their respective portfolios. So what I'm seeing is that the cost of capital for traditional oil and gas projects is steadily going up. What that means is that the hurdle rate for a particular project to be able to gain muster in the boardroom of an oil and gas firm, that hurdle rate is now progressively going up. My concern with all of this is that in the short to medium term scenario, this is going to bring about certain, peculiarities, in the global energy system. That's going to make the imperative of energy security very difficult, and especially in the context of the war that we are seeing right now between Russia and Ukraine, the importance of energy security is now coming to the fore. I have a feeling that given the high gestation, the large gestation period of a lot of renewable energy projects, such as a solar project or a wind turbine project, etc., it is important that we are able to strike a proper balance between the need for oil and gas and the need for us to transition to a greener future. So, stigmatization and, perception is, in conclusion, what I would say, a big problem for the oil and gas industry today.
I feel double-sided about, as much as I completely agree with you, there is this maybe exacerbation of the feeling regarding the source. I feel there's still this absolutely critical need of churning the current process of generating the energy from fossil fuel, turning it less impactful, more sustainable, less damaging to the environment. But I definitely want to go back to you later today. So we are going to talk about that as well. And so Donato, before we get into your question, would you like to comment on anything that, Ankit just said?
No, I think there is this exacerbation. And probably things are not going to change as quick as they have been showed. Like, it's not going to be a magic pace or something like that, that will change everything. And this is a process. I think you have to be smart to take advantage of the options that we have available.
Exactly. And it's never going to be a one size fits all, right? I do like the term that Ankit used, which is supposed to be a balance and per region, because it all depends on the natural resources you have or how are the access that you have to innovations and technologies and the policies that you have in place, and the security side that Ankit mentioned is also critical to be discussing. But Donato, you know, as talking about having access to natural resources, right? Brazil, as we know, is a reference in renewable energies. And I read that, you know, we have the capacity to generate more than 80% of its energies from the renewable sources. So what do you believe are some of the most innovative solutions that Brazilian companies have implemented to manage our energy consumption?
Okay, thank you very much, Maria. Well, last year, in Brazil, most of the capacity, installed capacity for producing electricity, more than 65% of the capacity is hydropower. And so when it rains a lot, we can attain most of the consumption of the energy consumption with renewables. Last year, it was a rainy year. So 92% of the energy consumption was attended, it was supplied by renewables, mostly hydropower. And then we can add solar power, wind power, 13%, wind power and solar power and biomass. So with these four sources, Brazil can attain like 92%, could attend in last year, 92% of the electricity with renewables. And here in Brazil, when you talk about consumers, I think there are two classes of consumers. The large consumers, the one connected to the high voltage, they can choose the energy supplier. So they can be innovative because they can negotiate the PPAs, negotiate the contracts, and they can be assured that all the energy they consume is produced by renewables. So nowadays, like in the last years, what we have seen, most of those consumers that have the right to choose the supplier, they have chosen renewables, mainly wind and solar and hydropower. And they can be their own supplier. They can be self-producers. So they can be part of the societies that build and construct the plants. And they also start monitoring the consumption, because electricity, you see the wires, you see the transformers, you see the power plants, but you don't see the electricity. But you can feel, but you shouldn't, right? You shouldn't put your finger on the energy plug. So the devices now that monitor the energy consumption, those devices have given tips and that have insights for the consumers to have more flat consumption. So they avoid the peaks, they avoid the overload of the system, they avoid investments for expanding the system because they consume the electricity better than in the past. So those are the main from in the physical field, like when you see the apparatus that supply electricity, those are the main innovations that we can see. But there are other innovations that we can't see so clearly, but those consumers, they have realized the value of data. So when they analyze how the energy is produced, how the energy is influenced by the weather, mainly the very critical weather events that we have experienced recently, and then can see how the consumption changes according to their process, like the production or some good, and they can see the energy consumption changing, and then can change the process to make a better use of the electricity. So I think that is very important, the power of data in promoting innovations in the energy consumptions. And we are seeing more and more companies using artificial intelligence for the energy consumption, mainly to forecast the energy price, to forecast the wind, to forecast the sun, the insolation rate, to forecast that's very hard, but the water in the rivers. So you can choose the source that you are going to use according to its availability, and then it can reduce cost. And that is just one more thing that I'd like to highlight. Last year, because of the Ukrainian war, the prices of the fossil fuels, they went to the peaks, they went to the sky. And what we saw, like in England, more than 30 trading companies, they went to bankruptcy. And in the same market, more than 40 survived. And there are two or three that did really well. They really increased their bases of clients, and now they are bigger than in the beginning before the crisis. And why? Because they had good portfolio management algorithms, and of course before the algorithms methodologies. So you've put together artificial intelligence, data, and portfolio management, you can have more, you can take more advantage of the renewables and of the energy sources as a whole, including the fossil fuels.
Yeah, makes sense. Super interesting, Donato. Ankit, you know, when we were first talking, our, you know, famous introduction call here, Future Hacker, you told me about so many interesting initiatives that I honestly have never heard before. When we were discussing, you know, ways that companies are researching and investing in solutions to reduce the impact of fossil fuels, you know, so to try to make the whole supply chain less impactful and less damaging to the world. Could you highlight some of the most interesting ones?
Yeah, sure, Maria. And I assume that the context of your question is, what are the oil and gas companies doing to somehow reduce their hydrocarbon footprint and intensity? So that's a fantastic question. The one initiative that I personally like a lot, that a lot of companies in the oil and gas industry these days are adopting, is what we call the Global Methane Initiative. As all of us know, methane, molecule for molecule, is 20 times more greenhouse causing than carbon dioxide. Now, what happens in various oil and gas installations is that methane tends to, being a lighter fraction of hydrocarbon, it tends to seep out of flanges and elbows and joints and so on. And it's astonishing, you know, the global emission of methane, we call them fugitive emissions, that's happening across oil and gas installations across the world. So a lot of global oil and gas companies have come together to be a part of what is known as the Global Methane Initiative, under which a lot of oil and gas companies are taking these, the initiative of trying to eliminate to the extent possible, to the maximum extent possible, the methane emissions that are happening in a fugitive way from you know, the various flanges and elbows and so on. Almost every company that I can think of that we are working with and that we are serving today as a contractor, all of these companies have signed up for this initiative. And I think this is a fantastic change for good. If we can limit those emissions, not only can we save the world from greenhouse effects, we can also use that methane for more productive purposes, such as, you know, for cooking food and for running automobiles and so on. The second initiative, and this is more on the business side that a lot of companies and organizations today are taking, and I should say the likes of ExxonMobil, etc., are taking the lead on this, is what is known as carbon sequestration, carbon capture and sequestration. So the idea here is that the carbon dioxide that is produced in various industrial processes, for example, the carbon dioxide that is emitted in the production of cement, clinker, and steel, etc., if it can be captured and pushed down subterranean caverns where they can be kept for hundreds of years, you know, under pressure and sequestered in the Earth's crust, that is one way of eliminating carbon dioxide from the atmosphere, or at least that's one way of making sure that the additional carbon dioxide that is getting added to the atmosphere every year because of industrial activity, a significant part of it can be sequestered below the ground. Now, what is happening with this initiative is that there is a bit of a opinion, you know, there's a bit of a difference of opinion, I should say. There is a class of people who say that, yeah, this is a fantastic idea. This is going to allow us to continue with industrial development while at the same time taking care of the carbon dioxide by pushing it into the Earth's crust. And then there is the other set of people who say that, hey, if we do that, then the larger, the more important purpose of reducing the overall carbon dioxide emissions over a period of time in aggregate is not going to be helped. So I would say that opinion is kind of polarized along these two lines. Speaking for my own company, speaking for our organization, I must say that we have taken a number of fantastic initiatives in one of the projects that we recently delivered. This is a massive FPSO. It's a very large crude carrier FPSO that we have installed in the Bay of Bengal on the east coast of India. This is an FPSO in which we have, for the very first time anywhere in Asia, installed what we call low NOx burners, that is low nitrogen dioxide emitting burners. So what this technology does is that it increases the combustion intensity of the gases that we are combusting to produce electricity on this particular offshore oil and gas installation. So what happens is that because of better combustion and because of a particular way in which the burner has been designed, the nitrogen dioxide emissions that come out of this facility are limited to below 40 parts per million. And that's fantastic from the standpoint of reducing the overall greenhouse footprint of the FPSO, because nitrogen dioxide and other nitrous gases also contribute a lot to global warming. The second thing that we have done on this FPSO, on this production platform, is that we are using waste heat recovery units. So what happens is that the gases that get produced as a result of this combustion process, they themselves carry a lot of heat, which gets lost into the atmosphere when we emit those gases into the atmosphere. So what we have used in this FPSO is what we call a waste heat recovery unit, so that the heat that is getting emitted with the exhaust gases can be used to heat up the oil in this waste heat recovery unit. And that oil can then be used to provide heating for the processes on board the platform. So in this way, we can make the same molecule of energy go a longer distance in terms of providing the heat requirements of the facility, thereby improving the overall hydrocarbon footprint of the facility. These are some of the things that I can think of as far as our industry is concerned. But I must also say that one of the things I remember discussing with you was some of these other ideas that people are trying. For example, I talked to you about the possibilities of people trying out sulfur dioxide or sulfate particle scattering in the atmosphere, which is again an initiative that some of the universities in the US are taking, whereby those particles can probably be dispersed in the stratosphere and infrared rays of the sun hitting the planet Earth can be dispersed in the atmosphere right off the bat. But I think there again, we have that. That's right, back into the space. But I guess there again, the opinion is divided. There is one school of thought which says that, hey, in the short to medium term, this is a good way of reducing the overall increase in the Earth's temperature. But on the other hand, there are people who say that if we do that, then the incentive for the industries and the governments to reduce the carbon dioxide emission on a basis is going to be taken away. So therefore, why get down a path which is not going to allow us to reduce the overall carbon dioxide emission intensity of the planet?
And that's a very interesting discussion. I also heard a third opinion about those researches when it comes to reflecting the sunlight or gathering the carbon and putting there down the earth. And I was talking to this scientist, and his concern was that we can't possibly predict the behavior in a longer term. And he's saying this could be something really scary to do, whatever we are putting on the air or whatever we are putting down the earth, and thinking decades and decades from now, we could be really screwing up somehow and we won't know, right? So there's this side as well from scientists, or this specific person that I talked to. I haven't interviewed him yet. But when you don't know that much about the subject and you just hear about those ideas, and you're like, okay, that could be scary if we're not 1,000% sure of what you're doing. And we can't, right? Because we don't know whichever movements the Earth are going to make or whatever is going to happen in the sun and the universe thousands of years from now. But I don't know. And also that I think it's interesting is how, when talking about climate change, usually carbon is more on the spotlight when compared to methane. But you know, as you said, if you go to the data, you know, there's so many more things that should be being addressed. And there's this carbon hype now with so many companies, you know, chasing the carbon credits and going carbon negative, which is super important. But still, there's this whole chain that we have to be thinking about. Donato, do you have any comments on that?
No, I think the carbon capture like is very new here in Brazil. We haven't, I don't know, at least facilities that use that. But we are starting searching for the places where we could capture the carbon.
Donato, so, you know, I'm going to have to introduce you to one of our guests that were here, Guido. So Guido, he's from Italy and he lives in Dubai. He's bringing his company to Brazil and I'm going to share the interview and people, you guys that are listening, just search here on YouTube, Guido Mercati. His interview is amazing. So his company, he's not only capturing carbon, so he captures carbon and he's fermenting it into a protein. It's out of this world. So, and he's actually bringing this to Brazil. Guys, you have to listen to the interview. Everyone, if you haven't listened to him yet, just search here. It's right here. I think it was either last week or 2 weeks ago that we put it live. Yes, we do have a couple of initiatives. We are searching for that. But as you're saying, it's pretty new in Brazil. One of our guests as well, Emily, she's the founder of Panties. We also have the interview down here in Future Hacker. And she became very knowledgeable and she's pro-carbon literacy. She goes to companies to talk about how to become actually carbon negative. So she actually manages to make her company carbon negative. It's such a long road and it's so much work, right? So, you know, we do have really a lot of bright people all around the world moving through those initiatives, a lot of exciting things to happen. But, you know, sorry, Donato, I interrupted you, but I had to talk about our dear future hackers. And can you just, you know, continue talking not only regarding this that is not only new here in Brazil, but also anything that you think it's interesting comment when it comes to innovations that we have here to decrease, you know, the impact, you know, to make the chain more sustainable.
Okay, for sure. Well, when we talk about the carbon, just one last comment, and then we go for the sustainability. Here in Brazil, we have some coal mines in the south of the country. Our coal is not good. We don't support that. And to keep it running, we need subsidies from the government. So we pay every year our bills, electricity bills are higher, because you're helping the coal mines in the south. And there, they have some projects for capturing the carbon and storing the carbon in some caves that they have in the south, even under the sea. So that's something that probably we are going to start from there, our energy capture initiatives. So when we talk about how to be sustainable, one thing that's very crucial, I think, is managing the grid, because from my point of view, when we talk about electricity utilities, we are talking a open sky industry, an open sky factory. So we have all the equipment installed everywhere. So geographically, it's a challenge because it's very dispersed. And so it's very dependable, or is very... the performance of this factor depends a lot of the weather conditions, and when you see those very extreme weather events as we had, like here in Brazil, the rain in the beginning of this year, but also in 2021 we have a really really severe drought. so those events they make really really tough for us to be sustainable, because when you have a drought, you start burning fossil oils to keep the energy flowing. That's what happened in 2021 here in Brazil. we didn't have money to pay the plant, so you have to make some loans and pay it in the future. And also there is one challenge that is know what is going on the field. So the technology of telecommunication, the sensors, and also to be able to operate the system from a central office, a central operating facility. So those are some initiatives that put the technology to help us to reduce the energy consumption and to be able to fight against those events if you know that in advance. And I think that's very crucial to talk to people. If you explain that the weather is very severe, so it's not raining for a long time, and you need to save electricity, people will respond accordingly if they feel that they can trust the authorities. But otherwise, if politicians don't like to say that we are running short of electricity, so normally they put all the available plants to operate. The cost is very high, but they don't pay for that. That's why they do that. But they have the votes of because the people is kept in like an illusion. There is free, cheap energy for everybody, and that's not the real thing. So I think you can use technology to improve the operation and to keep it running even in the extreme conditions. But we also can use technology to talk to people, to explain them, to educate them, so they will be part of the solution, not just of the problem. We don't have to make everybody consume electricity the way they want, regardless of what is going on with the nature, the weather, and so on.
Donato, that is so interesting, because when we were talking about, you know, having the government, you know, educate people, we do see that happening when it comes to water, right? So I can't forget all those times that, you know, we didn't have rain and you know, we're going to have scarcity of water. And then we have to go to those terrible times that, you know, we were from X time of the day to Y without water, you know. But, and then you would see all this communication from the government, but that's because there's no other way, right? Like, we didn't have it. When it comes to energy, and so there is another way, right? As much as, you know, it costs us in so many different aspects, so you don't see this effort coming from, you know, the government to try to change consumer behavior, because there's another way. So there's so interesting, like the motivations behind it. So they prefer, as much as we're paying for that somehow, they prefer to have the image that this nothing's happening. Yes, go ahead.
But we have mapped here more than 400 companies that are operating in developed markets. We see some companies that they were really bright in communication. There is one company, I'm not going to say the name, and I'm not sure if I can, but it's public. Okay. There is one company in California, it's named OnConnect. And the main call in their home site is help us to end California blackouts. So they put something that is very bad, that's very unpopular, that is the blackout, to have related with their purpose. If you come with us, we are going to reduce the blackouts. Why? Because we are going to tell you how to avoid consuming energy during the peak hours. So if you don't consume electricity during the peak hours, there will be no peak hours. So the assets that we have, they will be able to provide your consumption whenever you need it. Because now you don't put there are some people there talking, some consumers saying, okay, when I receive a message from OnConnect, I turn off everything in my house, I close it and I go for a bike. Then I go for a bike, I ride my bike like for 1-2 hours. I'm healthier because of that. And I really reduce my electricity bill. And I also help to end California blackouts. So people can understand if you communicate and also you give them some reward. If you do that, if you turn off all your equipment during the peak hours, we are going to have 50 cents of dollar or $1 per day because of that. So people can connect everything and understand. And the communication is very, very flow. They don't use technical terms. They speak in a language that people can understand. So I think that's crucial for the energy be part of the life of the persons, of the people. And normally, like, in my opinion, at least, it's 2 to 3 to 4% of the population wants to talk about electricity. I think the other part of the population probably have other things to be concerned. So you have to make things easy for them. So they just can understand and have some attitude about that, but that's not the center of their lives. They have kids, they have other things to do, they have their jobs. So I think it's crucial to keep it very simple and help the technology to give the right incentives for the people. If you reduce the peaks, you are reducing half of the problem.
Yeah. So, you know, as we're already talking about that, so I was going to ask Ankit something, but that's where I don't want to miss the thread here. And then I'm back to Ankit. Is that, so we're just talking about how user behavior plays this critical role, right? When talking about energy consumption. And, you know, we are used to always think that, you know, there's a blackout, you know, that's, you know, government issue, that's climate issue, but, you know, we have the habit of not bringing the problems to ourselves and see what we could be doing about it. But again, we need to be incentivized somehow, like, or educated, or I don't know. So what do you believe are the most effective ways to encourage people to adopt more sustainable energy practices? You know, that reminds me a lot. I interviewed a couple of behavior scientists, and I should think government should be using them more of how to communicate things to people. Like, this all over behavior science on that. But you know, you mentioned this company in California. Are there any other good cases that you could be sharing, or any ideas you could be sharing towards that?
Well, there is one that's really, it's amazing, because there was one company, they wanted to help people, like, to reduce the energy consumption, to be more efficient. And so they started telling people, if you reduce your energy consumption, if you replace your old equipment, if you change your habits, you can reduce your electricity bill, like, in $10, $20, or $30 a month. So do that. And people didn't do anything. So afterwards, they said, no, people are really interested in the environment. Let's talk to them. If you reduce your energy consumption, if you use it more efficiently, if you replace your old equipment, if you change your habits, you are going to avoid the planet destruction. And so you are going to reduce the greenhouse emissions, gases emissions. So do that. It's going to be health for the planet. And people didn't respond. So they had a clue, and it's really related with psychology. I'm not a psychologist.
So it's behavioral science pure. Tell me.
It's a pure relations. They said, okay, you have a house of some like 100 square feet or something like that, and your consumption is 800 or 80 kilowatt hours per month or something like that, or 100, 120. But look here at your neighbors. They are doing much better than you.
And yes, then people will start exactly. Responding. Exactly.
So this kind of a peer pressure, imagine
it, guys. Yeah. Guys, if you're listening to that, okay, that's like, I just keep remembering of all people that you interviewed. So guys, that speak, you know, everybody that is out there, just go to see the Jazz Groove's interview. He's a behavior scientist in UK. He had so many cases about that. Like, what are the drivers? What are the triggers? Right? And Daniel Kahneman is the biggest, you know, he has the book Noise and Think It Slow, and, you know. And for the Brazilians one, search for Flavia Avila's interview down here as well. So there are two behavior scientists that we thought we did talk to a couple of more, but those are the triggers. And actually yesterday, there was live, this interview that I did with Mario Ubiali. He works with neuroscience for food. And that's so interesting that he was just telling me, you know, most people that are vegan, they're not vegan because of nature. They're not vegan. So he was just telling the reasons that we all think that people are vegan for. And he's like, that's not the reason. Like, because when you go to neuroscience and you're measuring whatever is triggering your brain, it's a very selfish decision. It's just very, very, it's intimate. It's like what they think is good for themselves. It's not regarding nature or animals or killing animals or anything like that. A lot of people are going to be angry when they hear me. So I didn't say any of that. Just go listen to Marius Jubialis because it's really interesting, right? But you know, back to energy and user behavior, but that's it. Like we need to understand what are people's true motives to go and try to promote change for good. That's at the end, that's the thing. But you know, Ankit, back to you. When we first talked, you mentioned to me something that I also found it very interesting because, you know, we are all here talking about climate change and what people and companies and governments should be doing. And then you mentioned this financial mismatch, where developing countries that are the ones polluting the most have no access to the investment needed in alternative sources. And on the other side, you have, you know, many rich regions and the big players, that maybe the rich regions don't have the natural conditions to take the most out of it. And you have, and then adding my thoughts to that, right? You have many founders and startups that do have access to the brain and innovations, and they have the big ideas and they lack the resources. And then you have the big players and that they do have the resources, but they don't have the structure or the tradition or the culture to chase that. So this mismatch is not only something that is regarding, it's social and non-inclusive, but it's also regarding this maybe this, the world is so intertwined right now that maybe more traditional players should be looking at whatever is happening on the startups and the small players and be able to invest more there as well. So could you cover that? You know, you brought the term financial mismatch and it made me think a lot about so many things. So what are your view about that?
Yeah, sure. Thanks. I think, Maria, that probably is the most important question of our times right now. And I will try to address this question from the macro perspective and then, if possible, try to come to the micro end of things. See, there was a time when the key polluters of the world used to be the, you know, the first world countries or the countries that were designated to be the Schedule 2 countries about three decades ago. But over a period of time, what has happened is that the intensity of pollution emission, the intensity of carbon dioxide emission that is coming out of the developing world has increased significantly. And it has increased so much so that today, almost 65% of the global carbon dioxide emissions can be attributed to what we call the developing world. And only 35% to the developed world. So there are multiple issues with this matter. What happens is that, take a place such as Germany, for example. Now, it's a place that it's a developed country. It's a country that is covered with clouds for a fairly good part of the year, at least in many places, if not all. And yet, if you were to set up a solar power plant in Germany, the hurdle rate that you will need to cross in order to be able to designate a project as investable is very low, say about 6 or 7%. On the other hand, consider a country such as Egypt, for example, where you have sunshine 365 days a year, where 95% of the country is covered with deserts, which means that you can practically cover the entire country with solar panels and provide electricity for the whole world. But guess what? For you to be able to launch a solar power project in Egypt, you will need to cross a hurdle rate of 28 to 30% in order to be able to take the decision to go forward. Now, why is that so? It all boils down to the cost of capital and the availability of finance. Germany, being a part of the European Union, and the fact that they have a hard currency, which currency can be put to use at a hurdle rate that is significantly lower than what it would be in a developing country. you can have far many more projects getting off the anvil. But would you want to install a solar project in Germany, or rather do that in Egypt, if you had the choice? If this decision making thing of the cost of capital were to be taken away, where would you rather put a solar power plant? And I think this is where the problem is. Now, what is happening is that I was recently reading a research paper. This paper has been brought out by the independent high level expert group on climate finance, and they gave some startling statistics in this paper. They said that if the world has to have even a shouting chance of meeting the Paris goals of net temperature, Earth's temperature rise by 1.5 degrees by 2050, then in that case, the developing world will need to spend almost $2.8 trillion per year in putting up renewable energy assets starting the year 2030. And they will have to continuously keep doing that for many, many decades thereafter. Guess how much money the entire world, that is the developed world and the developing world, invested in renewable energy assets in the year 2021? $650 billion. That's it. So you can imagine that from $650 billion for the entire world, worth of investment in green, renewable energy, smart grids, and so on and so forth in the year 2021, you need to move to a world where just the developing world will need to invest $2.8 to $3 trillion per year in 2030 to be able to carry out this task of meeting the Paris goals. I don't think you need me to tell you that unless something drastically different is done to the world's financial system, we are not going to be able to meet these goals. We are talking about taking billions to trillions. We had this COP26 event in Glasgow where the various participating countries had a huge go at one another. In fact, we saw that the participants kind of very naturally divided into the North Bloc and the South Bloc. And the countries that belong to the South Bloc, predominantly the developing countries of the world, they accused the countries of the North Bloc that the $100 billion that had been promised in yearly investments outflow from the developed world to the developing world in order to meet the climate goals has not been met. That was Glasgow. I can assure you that that has not been met even today. And we are talking about $100 billion of capital outflow from the developed world to the developing world. If we have not been able to get to even that level today, how are we going to get to a level of $2.8 trillion of investments per year in the developing world starting 2030? And I think this is a part that needs to be addressed. We need to find a way of, maybe a new Marshall Plan for green energy or something radically different. Maybe it will mean having a green World Bank, or it will probably mean having a universal carbon tax on all the carbon dioxide emitting companies and countries to be distributed thereafter to those countries that need it most. And I think very importantly also, what needs to be talked about is not just the investments that will be required in mitigation and adaptation. We also need to talk about what will happen to those countries that are poor countries, that are small island nations, where we see a lot of disruptions happening to projects because of hurricanes, because of tsunamis and so on. So you have a situation where a country is investing in a renewable energy asset and out comes this hurricane that levels the solar plant or the windmill for that matter. And then all the debt that the country or the company in that country would have raised in order to finance that project, then suddenly you are left with no project, but you are still on the hook to the creditors for repaying that money that you have taken in order to launch that project. So I think loss and damage, which in the oil and gas industry parlance is something that we usually tend to cover through what is known as car insurance. So in the event of a permanent loss or damage to a project because of a natural cause, we need to evolve a way of negating or writing off the debt that some of these smaller countries, some of these poorer countries have taken in order to get these projects on the anvil. Unless and until we do that, I'm afraid a lot of what we are discussing in today's podcast, and also what we hear about and read about a lot in the press, is going to be just that. A lot of talk, but little action. Now, coming to the micro side of things, you would recall that about a decade ago, we had this green sort of investment cycle that had started in the 2010s and the early 2010s, late 2000s. Almost $50-60 billion were invested in various startup companies and so on, but the investors lost their shirts. Somehow, for whatever reasons, those ideas and those companies were not able to gain scale. What I'm seeing this time is that the governments are trying to really work hard, especially the governments in the European Union and also in the United States. Governments are trying to work hard to put in place policies, put in place incentives that will allow a lot of these new startups to gain traction and to be able to come out with results that will be able to be scaled to utility scales as the time goes by. So I do feel that there is a shift that has happened for the better in the private sector. But I would again preface that by saying, or I will again qualify that by saying that a lot of what we are seeing happening in the private sector, a lot of investments that we're seeing coming in the private sector are coming in those economies where the costs of capital have historically been low, where, where the investors are already attuned to investing in green finance projects, and where the governments are doling out the incentives for a lot of these green companies and green projects to be successful. I would say, and again, you may probably disagree with me, but I'll hasten to say that a similar entrepreneurial action is yet to be seen on a mass scale in some of the developing economies where I feel it is required the most. And I think, therefore, to that extent, once again, even from the standpoint of spurring private investment, even from the standpoint of getting the private, investments going, private enterprise going, private innovation going, we need to find a way of addressing the cost of capital issues in the developing economies.
Yes, yes. For sure. Super important point, Ankit. But, after, everything you said and taking all the seriousness of the matter, I remember that you told me that still you are an optimistic about our future, right? And I remember I said, Maria, see what happened in COVID. Like, we were able to, in 1 year time, get all the vaccines done. So still you are hopeful that we'll figure it out, right? Is that so?
That's the way to go. That's the way to think about it. The world cannot but think in any other way. You see, COVID has been a fantastic advertisement of what humanity can do if we do decide to come together. Yes, we had our issues, yet there were people who were hoarding vaccines and so on. But still, at the United Nations level, at the regional level, intergovernmental level, we saw a lot of cooperation. We saw a lot of, spirit of action. And I think that is what we need to get to on the climate front. Some wise man once said that nothing concentrates your mind like an emergency. In the case of COVID, we had the people actually falling on the roads and dying. So maybe the minds, the collective minds of the world got concentrated very quickly. I think my concern is that climate is not something that you can, climate change is not something that you can experience from 1 second to the other, one day to the other. It is there in the background, and therefore people are not able to kind of visualize that it is happening nevertheless, right? So that concentration of minds, I think, is missing right now. But it can be done. The world has done something in COVID just recently. So there is no reason why the world can't come together to get together and get going on the climate matter.
Yeah, completely agree with you. So what about you, Donato? I have two final questions for you. So the first one is, talking about the future, and when you're mentioning you know, how companies are already being able to use data and to manage the grids. I also mentioned that some markets in here in Brazil for companies and still not the users, but it's going to change. People are going to start choosing the providers. So thinking about this movement just made me wonder that if you think that in the future, this will work more in an automated way with artificial intelligence, in which, you know, the grid itself will be able to choose whichever sources is going to be more efficient. And it doesn't, we'll have to be relying on the final user as well, neither on the providers. So do you think that somehow we will get in a way of whichever blockchain or whatever, whichever technology that is going to exist by then will be going to be able to use through artificial intelligence automatically? So it's sunny, let's grab, you know, let's take this energy from solar, it's windy or whatever, you know, it's snowy. So, you know, it's going to be another source. So this is going to be a smart system by itself. Do you think it's going to be ever possible? And, you know, just opening up the question, how you do you see the future? And if you feel yourself more as an optimistic or more pessimistic about whatever is going to happen.
Okay. No, I think it's already taking place. If you look for the Google that bought that company with the thermostat, the Nest, that's something that's really taking place. And nowadays, I was talking to a friend in England. He works for a trading company, for a retail energy company, indeed. And he was saying that the most popular product they have, it's what they call no bills. So what's the point there? You pay a fixed charge for like 5 to 7 years, and then you don't have electricity bill anymore. Why? Because they install the solar panels, the batteries, everything that you need in your place. During this 5 to 7 years, you pay for that. And afterwards, with the controllers, they can keep everything running in your place, and you don't have to care about electricity anymore. I think that's...
Where is that?
This is...
Which place. Region?
I'm not sure about the region, but I can talk to him. I think it's all...
That's really cool, okay. Yeah.
No grid. But if you go to Australia, in Australia, you have a huge country with a few people. And so the grid is very... The quality of the grid is not good. So people are turning off of the grid. They are going off the grid. And when they go off the grid, you have to live by yourself. And the only way to live by yourself is to have really a smart controller, because you're not going to be concerned about your electricity, if you are charging or not charging, if it's the sun or not. But this central controller can do that for you. And then you can connect all your appliances, normally a smart appliance. There is including the ones that produce electricity, the ones that store electricity, and the ones that consume electricity. And they all together, there is a central dispatch there for your house, and you can be off-grid. And there is one thing that the battery companies, they have already realized, that people are very proud of being off-grid. So what they are doing, they are developed, the design of the batteries is very, very fancy. So normally they put the battery out of the house to show to everybody that you are off-grid, and so that you are very modern, that you are... sophisticated, and you don't depend on the utility anymore. So I think in the future this movement is going to of controlling the appliances, not controlling the consumer habits, controlling the appliances and giving tips for the consumer, and going off grid. That's going to be a reality for most of the small consumers. And I think the grid itself and the large power stations, they are not going to disappear. Because all the industry and the large commerces, they need the grid, they need the centralized power, but the relationship will be very different. Nowadays, mainly here in Brazil, people tell you how they are going to charge you, they tell you the price, and then you have to pay. So we don't have choice. But I think in the future, you are going to still have the grid, but the consumer needs will be the center of the discussion, and people call that consumer centricity, but for me is realizing what people really need and giving them tips and insights and information to make that decision better than an informed one. So we are going to move to everything that will be based on people needs. And with the technology, we'll be able to control that, reduce emission, reduce the need for new capacity, reduce the need for electricity that's produced from fossil fuels. But it's part of a movement, and it is already taking place. There are among those 400 companies that I talked to you, that there is one in France. They don't say they have consumers. They say they have appliances, because they count the number of refrigerators, the number of air conditioner, the number of computers, everything that's connected to the grid. And they control those devices. They don't control people. They control the devices already. They communicate with the devices. I think that's the future. And there is one company in German. It's called Next, and they connected very small producers, and they dispatch their plants for them. And doing that, and they connect very small consumers, and they also dispatch the consumers, and they put everything together, and they reduce the cost. So I think that's the future. A lot of technology being used to help us to consume electricity and produce electricity in a better way. And just to put an end of that, there are some papers in that they say that when you talk to people and people change their behaviors, you can reduce the electricity bill like in 5 to 7%, mostly 10%. But when you start controlling the equipment and you put some algorithms and smart devices there, the economy can go up to 25%. So because the algorithm is working every day and all the time and making the using data from the predictions and adjusting according to your habits, so it's much more efficient. I think that's the future. The future is having what we can call that is intelligent system, but those controllers, they will give us efficiency, and people will go off grid. They'll be proud of that. And for the large consumers, they still be connected, but in a different way. The power will be of them, not of the utility.
You know, that sounds very exciting, Donato. Guys, I really loved our conversation. It was great. A lot of important content. And, you know, it's a pressing issue. And people sometimes, you hear so much on the media that I think people sometimes just stop listening. So, you know, we have to keep discussing and see solutions out there. I just loved the idea of a green world bank that Ankit mentioned. It just made my mind like start with 1,000 thoughts. And who knows, within this green world bank, this hub to invest in the best solutions that could be out there. So I do think there's a lot of exciting things to happen, but you know, people be mindful of that and do your research and see there's so many interesting things happening out there. I hope, you know, countries and governments are able to do more of its job and exchange and collab, you know, collaboration is the word as well. We have to get together on that, as Ankit said. Guys, it was a pleasure. If, you know, Ankit, you have any, you know, final thoughts, and Donato as well, I'll leave the final word with you guys. It was, you know, a great conversation. Thank you so much for your time with us.
Thank you. Thank you, Maria. I think we are living in very exciting times. Probably you should this is a suggestion. You should probably have a podcast with the folks who are, for example, working on the nuclear fusion side of things. I think there is some fantastic work happening there. And honestly, if I were to sort of stick my neck out 30, 40 years down the line, I would love for this world to be running on nuclear fusion. And I feel that probably that may just end up happening in our own lifetimes. So yeah, we are living in interesting times, and I think we need to just keep pushing the boundaries of our lives, our science, and our reality to get there. Thank you so much once again for having me on this podcast. It was such a pleasure talking to you and to Donato. I have learned a lot, to be totally honest with you. Thanks once again.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you very much, Ankit. Thank you very much, Maria. I think it was really exciting. Normally, when we ended the podcast, if you are thinking about a lot of different things, that's because it was really good. And I think it was really good. I'd like to thank Ankit, and also thank you for this opportunity. And I just think, like, if you want to really understand, like, the future of electricity, we should thinking about people. Because normally people don't say, oh, today is a sunny day, I'm going to consume electricity. People have some needs, and most of those needs can be somehow attended or by using some kinds of apparatus or equipment or things that can use electricity. So in the center of everything, you have to think about people and how to attend their needs better. With less impact in a very sustainable way. No one should be left behind. So I think that you should have in mind. So thank you very much. I have learned a lot.
Thank you, guys. Thanks everybody for listening.
Future Hacker. Life. Path. Future.